with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. And welcome to Robots episode number 146, the last episode of 2013. My name is Jana, and today we will be hearing about task planning in robot teams from internationally renowned expert Lynn Parker. But first, on behalf of the team behind the Robots podcast, I would like to say a huge thank you to all our listeners who dug deep and made donations in response to our call for vital funds to keep us going. We're really pleased to say that we've collected over $1,500 in donations coming in from all over the world. So thanks to you, we'll be able to keep you informed about what's hot and what's not in robotics in 2014. And now, as always, let's get the latest news and developments in robotics from Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Lots of robotics news in the past couple of weeks. First off, the DARPA Robotics Challenge or DRC trials are over. As you may remember from our previous reports, the DRC is a prize competition funded by the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency with the aim to develop semi-autonomous ground robots that can do complex tasks in dangerous, degraded, human-engineered environments, such as a damaged nuclear reactor or an urban battlefield. In last week's trials, 16 teams competed in a series of 8 tasks, from operating a vehicle to opening a door, walking through debris, climbing an industrial ladder, or breaking through a wall using a light tool. The trials tasks were easier than those expected for the finals. For example, teams were allowed to begin with a robot already positioned in the vehicle for the current trial challenge, whereas they will likely have to equip and program the robots to enter vehicles by themselves in the finals. The main goals of the trials challenge were to allow a first appraisal of the current state of affairs and to determine which 8 of the 16 teams would qualify for up to $1 million in DARPA funding each for the next phase of the competition. The 8 DRC trial winners were Team Shaft with 27 points, IHMC Robotics 20 points, Tartan Rescue 18 points, MIT 16 points, RoboSimian 14 points, Team Track Labs and Rex both 11 points, Team Trooper with 9 points. The 8 winners will now have close to a year before they compete in the DRC finals at the end of 2014, alongside with other teams that managed to qualify in another pre-challenge event to be held before then. The date and location of the finals has yet to be announced, but DARPA promises a more authentic mission for disaster response as the final challenge. In other major robotics news, U.S. software giant Google announced the purchase of Boston Dynamics, the formerly privately held company very well known for developing dynamic walking robots like the Big Dog, Cheetah, or the Atlas Humanoid, used by 5 of the 8 winning teams of the DARPA DRC trials. This latest acquisition brings Google's robotics company portfolio to 8. And while Google's robotics plan remains unclear, all signs point to a near-term rather than long-term intention for using their newly found robotics muscle. In other news, China has soft-landed its robot rover U2, or Jade Rabbit, on the moon. During its 3-month exploration, U2 will search the moon dust for natural resources and rare elements such as titanium and uranium. The robot landing fits into China's wider ambitious plans to become a global leader in robotics with an expected annual growth rate of 25%, according to China's Deputy Director of the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, Wang Weiming. And finally, a video of the robotic cube Cubely, which, as you may remember from earlier news, can jump up, balance, and walk using 3 momentum wheels, has gone viral and already received more than 3 million online views since it was posted last week. The Cubely has no immediate application and was created by researchers at the Institute for Dynamic Systems and Control at ETH Zurich as an exercise in dynamics and control. For more information on the DARPA Robotics Challenge trials, Google's acquisition of Boston Dynamics, and a video of Cubely. Have a look at robohub.org.
Lynn Parker is professor and associate head at the Distributed Intelligence Laboratory within the Department of Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Tennessee. She's recognized as one of the leading world experts in the field of multi-robot systems. Her current research is focused on computational issues of distributed intelligence systems, such as multi-robot teams and sensor networks. Lynn spoke to our interviewer Pear about how groups of robots can share tasks and data, how they might form teams, and how they could determine who has the ability to help the team, either by providing a vantage point for a sensor or based on being able to perform a certain task.
So, welcome to the podcast. As you might hear today, I am really hoarse, so I'm going to talk as little as I can. But we're going to hear interesting stuff from Lynn Parker of University of Tennessee, Knoxville, about task planning and human-robot interaction and cooperation. So should we start historically? Any older research that you'd like to promote and inform people about
Sure.
that might be interesting?
Sure. So my research career for the last many years has dealt with how do you decide when you have teams of heterogeneous robots that have different kinds of capabilities, how do you decide which robot should do which to do what? And so that's really historically what we call the task allocation problem. You want to have a group of robots to perform a group of tasks. They're heterogeneous, and so the different mappings of robots to task is a challenge, and you want to do that efficiently. So in the early days of my research, we would look at what we would call single tasks or loosely coupled tasks, and these are those that each robot could perform a single task all on its own. But and so that's a hard problem, and we came up with several solutions. Our main contribution there is coming up with a way to enable robots to decide how to interact based on implicit cooperation. So they did not have to explicitly exchange information. They didn't have to negotiate with each other to decide who would do what, but instead they would observe what the other robots are doing. Now, in the early days, this was through communication. They would just broadcast what they were doing to each other.
Not then, in sensors like cameras and other
right,
things.
Right, in the early days.
Simulated. So
yes, simulated implicit communication. But then the robots would decide who should do what, and they'd make their own decisions on who should do what. Now, that was an interesting contribution. We've looked at more difficult problems since then, which are problems in which the task requires more than one robot at a time to accomplish. And so these are tasks that require what we call coalitions to execute. So coalitions are teams of robots, all of whom need to be working together on a single task. Sometimes these are called tightly coupled tasks because each robot has to carefully take into account what the others are doing while it's performing the task. Our focus has been on, again, heterogeneous robots, so that each robot is contributing certain resources, certain capabilities, maybe certain sensors, certain effectors, and so forth, to the task. And it's a combination of capabilities across multiple robots that gives you the coalition. So from a planning perspective, the question is, how do you decide which robot should perform which part of a coalition and which groupings of robots make the most sense for forming coalitions? And so I've looked at that for the past several years, and most recently we're now starting to look at not only having multiple robots together to perform a single task, but then also to have those robots be multitasking. So not only do they work in one coalition with a group of robots toward one task, but they work with multiple groups of multiple robots to perform more than one task at a time.
And trying to optimize the whole
thing. Yeah. Of course, it's well known that these problems are intractable to solve optimally, but you can come up with some good solutions by decomposing the problem. And so what we do is that we solve for one coalition, and then we look at synergistic coalitions that can happen in parallel, perhaps with some robots being members of both coalitions so that you can accomplish more than one task at a time.
Mm-hmm. Because we're not aiming for the optimum, we're aiming for as good as we can.
Right.
But that would raise efficiency very significantly above us not doing this at all, of course.
Exactly, yeah, so exactly.
It's very worthwhile, even though we're not reaching the end state.
Exactly.
One thing I'd like to connect back to was this simulated thing we talked about. Isn't there, I mean, robots can communicate in other ways than animals and humans can. Was there a significant downside to actually having them communicate the way robots can? Why can't they just tell each other over a network what they're doing? And if that doesn't work, they can use a camera or another sensor, because it must be much easier to deal with this robot-to-robot communication. Is there
right.
a problem with that? Or?
So I think there's trade-offs. In some situations, the amount of information that robots need to exchange in order to make really good decisions is more than the bandwidth that you have available. Another problem is that it doesn't scale well as you get to larger and larger teams of robots, because then, you know, it's n squared amount of work or amount of communication. As the team size gets larger and larger, then it's harder to communicate directly and to communicate everything that needs to be communicated to properly perform the task. So this is why we look at implicit communication.
Each robot itself decides what information it needs by looking at the world, and
right.
scales much better.
Right, it scales much better. It is harder because it requires solving a perception problem that's not easy. And so there's still much work that has to be done in order to really make implicit communication work well. But we think it scales better. And it's not to say that there aren't situations where you want to communicate some information. We're not...
A combination of both.
It's a combination.
Yeah.
And I think we're really trying to push the envelope of what can be done implicitly. If you could solve everything implicitly, then I think it's a win.
But it's hard.
It's hard. Mm. It's hard. So that's why we study it.
And it might also be slightly pointless trying to do it the hard way when the easy way works. But when the easy way, as it said, it doesn't scale, it has other problems... Then we use both methods for
right.
what they're good
exactly.
at.
Exactly. Mm. And sometimes, of course, you get interference with the wireless, and the communication is so noisy that if you're completely dependent on that communication, then you're sort of dead in the water if you don't have it. And that really goes back to one of the motivations, back to my PhD work, was to argue that in cases where you're, for whatever reason, you're a wireless communication mechanism is not available, then if you don't have any way to implicitly figure out what other robots are doing and make decisions without requiring that, without having that communication, then you can do nothing. And so it's not to say that sometimes you don't want to use the communication, but you would like to not just be completely dead without it.
Redundancy is, of course,
right.
always important.
Right, right.
So now you're trying to optimize these teams of robots to perform not only one task together, but many tasks together. This must be a very challenging issue. Can you tell us a bit more about what kind of task you're trying to address right now and what challenges are in doing that?
Sure. Well, we're trying to develop formal theories that will apply to a lot of different kinds of applications. The sorts of applications we're looking at are things like material transport, surveillance, perhaps exploration, these sorts of tasks. So what we try to do then is to come up with some general theories that will apply to a lot of different application domains, such as reconnaissance, material transport, surveillance, and this sort of thing. Our approach is to allow the robots to model their capabilities at a very low level so that they can then mix and match these capabilities to address different kinds of problems or to address the same problem in different ways, depending upon what the other robots can do that are nearby and available. And so our approach is based on what we call sensory computational systems. And these sensory computational systems consist of combinations of low-level capabilities, including sensing, communication, computation, and effectors. And each robot has modeled it in the low level, sort of like schemas, each of their abilities. And then our planning system is able to mix and match the required components based on our view of the information requirements of a task. And so each task requires a certain type of information, certain quantity of information, and the robots decide how to connect their components both within their own each own robot as well as across robots so that you have the right information flow that achieves the task at hand. And so the combination of all of these capabilities across within an individual robot and across multiple robots give you these coalitions that I've been talking about. And so each of these coalitions then can work together toward a task such as material transport. And then if you have something changes in the problem, maybe the problem changes or the team changes or the environment changes, then the robots can recognize that and react and reconfigure their software. So our approach is what we call a symmetry, and part of the acronym asymmetry stands for software reconfiguration. And so this is something we want automatically to happen at both the individual robot level and at the team level. So we're really looking at theoretical ways of solving multiple kinds of tasks, but to have it solved very autonomously so that the human designer or the domain expert doesn't have to resolve every problem for every different application, for every different set of robots, for every different set of sensors. And so that's what our approach is really aimed toward, is having general solutions for coalition formation that are applicable to a broad range of tasks.
That's actually the only approach that had any chance of success, right? Because you have generations of robots. We're going to have an older robot with less capability and a new robot with
right.
more capability.
Right.
And as you said, the environment is going to change all the time.
Yes.
And of course, the task changes drastically.
Exactly. Now, the early motivation for this work was a project that we worked on collectively with some other researchers. And those researchers, the other researchers, were in charge of coming up with the hardware specifications for the robots. And me and my graduate students were coming up with the software in order to make use of that hardware. The problem was that during the design of the hardware, the particular choices would affect, obviously, how the software was written. And the project had a very ambitious schedule. And so we had to work very quickly, and my students had to work very quickly. But the problem was the hardware was not completed by the time that we needed to start working on the software. So the hardware designers kept changing their mind. And every time they changed their mind, my poor graduate students had to start all over and rewrite the software control because it was very different depending upon what combinations of sensors that you had. Now, our task was not changing. The robots were still supposed to do an exploration and detection kind of task. So the task never changed. But the robot hardware specifications were changing, and that meant the software kept changing. And all the labor was in my students' time and in their heads. And so this is really the early motivation for this approach, is that we want a software technique that can automatically react and deal with different configurations of hardware without, even if the task is the same, you don't want to have to completely rewrite everything. And so this was really our early motivation for coming up with these general techniques, is to keep it so that you didn't have human labor rewriting the software every time that the capabilities changed.
Again, doesn't scale.
Right.
I mean,
that's exactly it.
You would be 10% into rewriting when you had to start rewrite again because there's a newer, better, cheaper robot or just better, different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And of course, is there any kind of scope? How much could I change the robot? How different could they be? Do they have to be reasonably similar, or can they be widely different?
They can be fairly widely different. What you would do as sort of the human designer, the human manager of the team, is you would, one time at the very beginning, you would design what we call the schemas that represent all of the capabilities of that new robot. And so certainly the robot has to be given some capabilities to do some things, but they would be modeled and programmed as low-level behaviors. Those low-level behaviors or schemas then go into just a library, and tagged with the inputs and outputs of these schemas would be what we call the information semantics. And that information semantics then gives us what we need, what the robots need, in order to mix and match capabilities in the future. So once you have a library that's modeled according to the framework that we've developed, then it's reusable for multiple tasks. So anytime you bring in a new capability, you have to add those schemas to the library at the beginning, and hopefully no more after that. You can use them.
So if somebody comes out with a robot that is really different, but has, say, 80% similarities, we could use those 80%. We add the 20%. And when somebody comes out with a third robot that is similar to this previously very odd robot, they would match and it would be back in the library already.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So it's all about reusing what's already been developed, what's already been used. And then also we added the ability for robots to learn and then add to the library autonomously. So if the robots could themselves learn some new capabilities based on a variety of machine learning techniques, then they could use those to and themselves add to the library instead of the humans having to add everything one by one.
So it's basically a robot reprogram thyself.
To some extent, yes. Yeah.
Is it so that it tweaks what the human did or kind of adjusts it a bit? Or is it, I guess it's not coming up with
it could
all
be,
new things?
Well, I mean, it could be either. Certainly parameter tuning is easier and more common. But that is a flavor of techniques that a lot of our research includes is machine learning techniques. And so we have the ability to reconfigure these schemas in order to solve tasks in a different way. But then the robots themselves also have the ability to tune what they're doing. That would be through parameter tuning. Or if you explicitly wrote a behavior for robots that enabled them to do some exploration, some trial and error, to learn some new tasks, then once they had learned those, they could add them to the library as well. So it's both kinds of sort of an adaptation as well as learning of new behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about any practical experiment you carried out and test to test these?
Well, sure. Some of the experiments that we do are some of the canonical problems that are often looked at in multi-robot systems, which are problems of exploration, trying to come up with a map of an unknown environment, find objects that may be of interest, perhaps monitor the environment to see if humans may be coming through the area and keeping track of the people as they move through the area, perhaps to protect some objects of interest. Box pushing is a canonical multi-robot task, and so we've looked at variations of the box pushing task. Some sorts of formation control, things like formation keeping, follow the leader, or other sorts of more complex formations are types of tasks that we have demonstrated through these techniques as well.
Where multiple robots, for instance, lift a heavier object than each robot could do
exactly.
on their own.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I also understand that you use multiple robots to provide if one robot is moving the box but doesn't see where it's going.
Oh, yes.
The sensor data can be exchanged. And the robot that doesn't actually see where it's going can utilize the sensors
exactly.
on this other robot that has a good point of view.
Yes. So the idea is that for different scenarios, depending upon what the robots can and can't do, other robots, again, can form a coalition in different ways in order to help provide the assistance that's needed. I always use the example of if you're blind and I'm deaf, then I can be your eyes and you can be my ears, and together we can work out whatever the problem is. And so similarly with the robots, if they're able to see and able to have all the capabilities that they need, then they're free to go about their task individually. But as the problem domain gets more and more difficult, then the other robots can join in to help. So in the box pushing example that we talked about, if a robot's viewpoint was blocked about how to get to the goal, another robot that could see both the goal and the robots pushing the box could then be part of the coalition to help provide the information that's needed so that the pushers could get to where they need to go.
Yeah, and of course, getting this robot that doesn't see to ask the correct robot for the correct information, that must be one of the really hard parts, because it knows about all the robots in the coalition, but who to ask, because it doesn't know what the other robot sees. How is that process handled?
Well, again, it's all based on information flow. And so a robot that sees will have the information that's needed. So say the goal position is the information that's needed in order to accomplish the task. So robots that are within line of sight of the goal would clearly be the ones that would have that information, whereas others would not. And so the robots can exchange some low-level information about the knowledge that they, or the information that they have about the world. It's not a lot, it's not a long list of information, but it's a short list that they can exchange so that then they can use this for the forming of the coalition.
So this robot broadcasts, I see the goal,
yes.
I see you, and then this robot, I don't see the goal, but I know you do by the information this,
right.
this robot broadcasts.
Right. Yeah. So it's some succinct but important pieces of information that the robots can exchange so that then they can make use of that for forming the proper coalitions with mm-hmm. the right robots. Mm.
I understand that your current work is also focused on getting humans to work with robots and carrying over this implicit instruction set so that the human doesn't have to give explicit orders to explicit robots, but can be assisted with their task anyway.
Exactly.
That would be very interesting for our listeners, I think.
Exactly. What we're trying to do is push the envelope and look at tasks and ways of accomplishing tasks between humans and robots that does not require the human to directly pay attention to the robot or to directly command the robot or to give some gesture to tell the robot what to do. We're really looking at what's called peer-to-peer collaboration. So the robot is a peer of the human. The human is a peer of the robot. And so what that means is that you have to develop technologies that allow the robot to observe what it is that the human is doing, to somehow infer the intent of the human, and then to contribute to the task in some way that's cooperative. Now, it's difficult to do this if the robot has never seen the human before, and it's hard to infer intent if you have no clue. So our concept is that just like human teams that practice together, they know how to do a task together, maybe they're a work crew, they're a painting crew, and so they spend their whole careers working as a team doing something like painting. They have worked together. They know each other very well. They can glance at each other and see what the other is doing. This is the same concept. So we want to have the robot-human teams to practice together on whatever their task is. But then after the practice, the human can go about doing their part of the task, and the human is free to choose whatever part of the task that he or she wants to do. And then the robot knows the task, knows generally how the human likes to perform the task, and then can pitch in and contribute to the accomplishment of the overall task consistent with what the human has decided to do. So this is really, again, pushing the envelope of what can you do implicitly without requiring specific command and control of the robot.
Mm. Must be a very hard problem, hopefully.
It is.
Can I interpret the human? Are you doing, you said that about training the team as a human team is trained. They usually have a niche language where they can go in and use very short sentences and direct commands because everybody knows what they're meaning.
Right.
Is that a form you're using? Are we speaking and gestures to the robot so that they information that way?
Yes, down the road, we anticipate that that will be an important part of our overall approach. What we're focusing on right now are a couple of things. First is just the perception side of the problem, where the robot can watch what the human is doing and it know just what is the human doing. Not yet looking at the intent aspect of the problem, but just looking at what the human is currently doing as it relates to the task that the robot knows needs to be done. The other aspect of it is trying to come up with technologies that allow us to determine how the robot should cooperate with the human once you know what the human is doing. So it's really a model of cooperation. Now, we've looked at different ways of doing this. One idea would be just to develop some sort of rule-based system or some sort of decision-making system that we as human designers develop that gives the robot some sort of decision-making capability to decide what to do when, depending upon what the human is doing. But we decided what our preference was is to instead look at models of how humans cooperate with other humans. And so we're doing some experiments now with humans performing different types of cooperative tasks. And we're videotaping it and recording it and now building from that statistical models that show us how it is that humans cooperate with other humans when they're performing certain tasks. Once we have that model built, we're going to give it to the robot so that the robot can now choose how to cooperate with the human once it's perceived what the human is doing. And our hope is that this will feel natural to the human because the robot is doing tasks and selecting what to do using a model that's consistent with how humans tend to cooperate with each other.
It would basically watch the team, and when it does that, it learns from the team members and responds as a team member would.
Right, exactly.
It becomes another. It's basically like getting an apprentice.
It is, exactly
just
like
that. Just that it runs on batteries.
Exactly.
That is very interesting.
Yes, and so this is still a work in progress. We've made a lot of progress in the perception side, and we're beginning, we're hoping to wrap up the modeling from our human subject studies very soon, and then we can incorporate that onto the robot, and then we can start seeing if we can put the system together so that the robot can respond properly to the human. Now, down the road, as you mentioned, having short phrases that the human can say and that immediately gives the robot some knowledge, say, of the context or the state of mind of the human, that will certainly be something down the road that we'll look at incorporating. But right now, we're working on the perception side and the modeling side so that they can perform implicit cooperation. Mm.
Because that communication might increase the reliability because...
Yes.
And I guess human teams do this all the time. They say short pieces of information that
right.
makes... Because we humans are very good at implicit communication and being an assistant to another human being is very natural for us. But we also have the explicit communication in form of language.
Exactly, exactly.
Is this also... I mean, when we're talking about doing a task together, is it like holding a piece of wood on a construction site because the robot's very strong and the human can do the fine motor skills and then use tools to fix the wood to the construction, or is there any other task we're talking about?
It could be that sort of thing. It could be a scenario where you're maybe in an office and you have various things that you need to do, perhaps to straighten the office, or if you're unloading boxes and you're trying to install them on shelves or unpack them. So it could be a variety of different sorts of things. We're looking at not just tightly coupled tasks in which the human might be holding something and the robot would hold the other end, but a whole variety of different kinds of tasks. Our perception system is really focusing on being able to distinguish a lot of different kinds of activities that are going on, not just a single activity. And so we want the robot to be able to pitch in a variety of activities, but it would be in a context. So it might be in a context of, say, a store or a home or an office setting. So that's the context that we're working on.
Like stocking shelves in a store, removing produce that are not
exactly.
suitable anymore.
Exactly.
And also maybe inventory. In the store, I mean, how many of that do we have, and
exactly.
have they expired? And
right, all of those would be good tasks for this sort of system.
Yeah, and it's a huge, huge market, of course.
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
And this is what you're working on now, and a bit into the future. If you would imagine us sitting here 10 years from now, what do you think you're working on?
We have
the this crazy. No, this is crazy idea now. You know.
Yeah. Well, so this whole idea of sort of human and robots acting implicitly together as peers, we've just really begun this work. We have a new robot that has, two human scale arms and a sophisticated sensor head. And so we are going to be able to do human scale tasks with that robot more so than we've been able to do in the past. And so this is really an area that we're beginning now. So in 10 years, I would like to think that we might have some good applications of this work. You know, a lot of people work on robots that are in the home environment to be helpful. One of the applications that we've been thinking about as well is being able to teach life skills to adults that maybe have some sort of learning disability. And so now the robot could be there in the same environment watching what the human is doing, but then also maybe being a coach or demonstrating the task in a to help perfect the skills of the adult with some learning disabilities. So I think there are a lot of different directions we could take this work once we have the ability to do the perception side and the ability to know how to properly interact with people in a way that seems natural to them.
Yeah, because we should interrupt the human as little as possible in their daily work, so to speak.
Right.
But assist them anyway.
Right.
Oh,
exactly.
Very interesting.
Exactly.
I'm looking forward to having a robotics journalist assistant here when I go to
very good. ITRA
2020.
Well, IRA call 2023. Us up in 20 years, 10 years, and we'll have that
2023,
for you.
2023, yes. I've got it. He probably has a better voice than
he
do,
might talk for you.
I'll be his assistant, I guess.
Yes.
So thank you very much for being part of the podcast. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. Our annual festive season greetings competition has once again received a number of impressive entries for 2013. And you can find some of them on our website and on our dedicated YouTube channel. The team behind the Robots podcast hopes that you are enjoying the festive season and wishes you a great start to the new year. We will be back in January. Until then, goodbye. Teamwork with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.